Well, what is digital therapeutics? It's software, not devices. Software as medicine. Right now, obviously, the regulatory environment is changing all the time. At the moment, they're still considering at the FDA software as a device, but really, it's not. It's really a digital drug, a digital medicine. It's a piece of software targeting a particular condition in a particular area of your brain, even. You're going to have a location-based, immersive experience to deal with your chronic conditions, neurological or otherwise. And it's the only way that the pharmacology or the devices will actually show maximal benefit. But the elephant in the room is so huge because people don't realize you need to put someone in a room to have a behavioral experience.
The Tomorrow Scale podcast is a series of conversations with the scientists and entrepreneurs who are building the future. We explore cutting-edge technologies with huge potential and go deep to understand how these founders and inventors must chart entirely new territory to bring their technology to market. We have discussions on a wide range of scientific frontiers, from life sciences to AI, nanotech and materials, to the very food we eat. And we'll talk about impacts, time horizons, and what's coming next. We'll learn, quite literally, how science fiction becomes reality. This is the Tomorrow Scale Podcast. So I'm joined today by Dr. John Krakauer. And today on this episode, we're going to discuss what digital therapeutics, robotics, virtual reality, and dolphins have in common. Our guest is the John C. Malone Professor of Neurology, Neuroscience, Physical Medicine, and Rehabilitation, and the director of the Brain, Learning, Animation, and Movement Laboratory at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, as well as the chief medical and scientific advisor to MindMaze, a company developing digital therapeutics, diagnostics, and devices for neurological conditions. Dr. Krakauer, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'd like to start off by getting an understanding of the patients that you treat and the problem that you're trying to solve. Can you help us understand what a stroke patient is facing after a ischemic event and the path of a patient to recovery, and talk about the touch points of your work along that recovery path?
Yes. So, you know, in my clinical duties, I'm a stroke neurologist. So I actually attend in neurological intensive care units and in acute stroke units. So I'm very much involved in the front end of patients who have strokes. So for those who don't know, a stroke, it came originally stroke because it comes out of the blue, like a stroke of lightning. So a patient can be fine 1 minute and the next minute they've lost flow of blood to a particular area of their brain. And that leads to a focal deficit. The most common after stroke is loss of power and motor control down one half of the body, and often loss of speech and language. There are many other consequences of focal lesions, but the two big ones are language and movement. So there's been a lot of exciting advances in the ability to remove clots very quickly within the first 6 hours of stroke, which has led to many patients surviving their strokes. But then what happens then is that they're left with these deficits, and now they need to recover from them. And recovery has really taken two forms. One is that you spontaneously recover. So patients tend, for the most part, to recover to some degree early on themselves, some sort of endogenous repair process. And then they also undergo rehabilitation.
And what percentage of patients recover on their own?
Well,
or to what degree is there kind of automatic recovery?
No, it's not so much recovering completely on your own.
Sure.
But one would say that perhaps at least two-thirds will have some degree of recovery. It's a minority that are basically as bad later as they were at the beginning. But we do actually talk about those non-recoverers, the ones who have very big strokes, who are very severe at the beginning. Some subset of patients actually do very poorly. But the majority of patients show some degree of what we call spontaneous biological recovery, right? We would always like to go beyond that. It tends not to reverse the deficit altogether. right? It improves it, but it doesn't reverse it.
And so what is the standard of care for rehabilitation?
Yeah, so the standard of care of rehabilitation, what happens is you go to the neurointensive care unit, then you go to an acute stroke unit. Let's say your average length of stay is about 5 days. And then after that, patients, you can divide them up into sort of three groups. One group will go to an acute rehabilitation unit, often in the same hospital, where they'll spend, let's say, on average, 10 days to 2 weeks. Another group will go to a subacute rehabilitation facility, where they get, instead of the usual 3 hours a day of occupational therapy, physical therapy, and speech therapy, which happens in an acute rehab unit, they may get a little less because they're so ill, so debilitated that they can't partake in that much rehab. And then another third will go home and get outpatient rehab. In all three buckets, you tend to get, as I said, occupational therapy, physical therapy, and speech therapy. These are usually 45 to 1 hour sessions with a therapist. Very crudely, you can consider occupational therapists worrying about your upper limb and how you cope in conditions of everyday life, like in a kitchen, for example. And physical therapy is more about movement, gait, and balance, and transferring out of bed to chair, toileting, things like that. And then speech is focused, of course, on speech and language and swallowing. So that's the standard of care, is 45 to 1 hour sessions, usually once a day, either in inpatient settings or in outpatient settings. The average length of stay for an inpatient is about 2 weeks, and then you will get outpatient care for 3 months, maybe 6 months, and then it tends to taper off depending on what your insurance pays for. So that's basically what happens. And the focus of rehabilitation is mainly, because you don't have that much time, to try and teach you through motor learning how to cope with what you have left.
And what's that window?
Well, we've done a lot of work on the window, and it's extremely important. Most recovery that you see spontaneously, in addition to patients getting rehab, occurs in the first 3 months. And we have reason to believe that most of that happens in the first, let's say, 6 to 8 weeks. Okay. So that's what it looks like. And then sort of rehab is riding on top of that self-repair. But the position that's concerned me is that we don't really give enough of the right kind of behavioral intervention to properly exploit this window of heightened plasticity early after stroke that lasts, let's say at best 3 months. And so the animal literature has suggested that if you throw the kitchen sink at a monkey model or a rodent model, and you give very high intensity, high dose behavioral therapy focused on quality of movement with the goal of having you go back to normal, you can get quite dramatic results, especially if you go early. Unfortunately, rehabilitation has been much more pragmatic and short-lived than that, which is, rather than doing all that high intensity, high dose, hours and hours and hours a day, let's teach you to cope so we can get you home as soon as possible.
Because you don't want to induce another stroke, right?
Well, there's been a literature going back to the 90s concerned about that, but it's probably not really borne out. In other words, as long as you don't overdo it in patients with large cortical strokes in the first, let's say, week, that's probably not going to happen. And also, if patients have very large strokes and they have impaired auto regulation, in other words, they can't modulate their blood pressure when they're standing up to properly perfuse their brain, that can be a little bit problematic as well. But with those two caveats, we have very little reason to believe that a substantial increase in the dose and intensity of behavioral intervention will have any deleterious effects, especially not infarct expansion. But that's the picture I want to draw. The animal model suggests that you can augment spontaneous recovery and exploit this plasticity. And in the human world, it was more about, let's just try and pragmatically get you to cope and get you out and get you home as soon as you can. You see, it's this slight, the difference between being a sort of weekend warrior of your disease versus being a supreme athlete of your disease.
And so you talked about intervening in different times in doing some of the animal models and what did that show?
There's been a lot of literature. I sort of wrote a book where I summarized almost a century of work looking mm-hmm. at what happens when you lesion, you know, the early work was done in monkeys. And then after you you give them a stroke-like deficit, what can happen if you really make them practice a lot on the lesioned side, on the side with the hemiparesis, and you can get dramatic recovery, right? And then we've done work at Hopkins in a mouse model with our colleagues, you know, led by another neurologist at Hopkins, Steve Zeiler, where we showed that if you give a mouse a stroke and then you really make it practice reaching movements within a day of its stroke, and you do this for 10 days to 2 weeks, you can return it back to its pre-stroke level of activity and reaching quality. So a lot of animal literature, you know, going back a century with what we ourselves have done, showing that you can get quite dramatic reversal of the deficit if you do this. And what we wanted to do is, how do you bring this type of care that has been shown in animal models to humans? And it was basically the road not taken by rehabilitation.
And so how did that put you on the path to these very fundamentally different tools? You left almost all the tools of the trade behind and went into motion capture and VR and gaming. And how did you make that leap?
I was aware that there had to be a way to reproduce the sort of environments and intensity and doses of treatment that were working in animal models. So there were these two pillars. One was what I've already discussed, which is do a lot more focused on the quality of what you do rather than just getting the task done. In other words, don't just hit any old backhand on the tennis court, hit a really good backhand kind of idea, right? And what's called in the animal literature for the last, let's say, 75 years, of enrichment. In other words, there's a lot of evidence to show that if you take a rodent in particular and you put it instead of a cage alone in isolation, but you put it in a cage full of toys and ramps and wheels and friends and places to explore, that that kind of fun enriched environment actually promotes plasticity. And so other investigators, for example, someone called Dale Corbett in Canada, have shown that if you combine this kind of fun-enriched background with a high-intensity, high-dose training foreground, that combination is optimal for recovery after brain injury or disease. So the challenge was, well, how do you do that? How do you get both of those things, a training environment that is fun?
Enter the dolphin.
Yes. So, you know, with two colleagues that I met from the computer science department at Hopkins, Omar Ahmad and Pramit Roy, when I first got to Hopkins, I'd obtained a grant when I was at Columbia, and I realized that I wanted to create a kind of gaming environment. What we realized is that animation, in other words, the joy that people get watching Disney and Pixar movies, you know, watching all that wonderful, colorful, stretchy, bouncy movement with a clue. And so the light bulb went off in our heads that, look, maybe the enriched environment for a human should be that feeling of being in one of those movies with that quality of animation, which forces you to be a character, be immersed, but also have to make high quality movements for long periods of time. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And so, but instead of just opening their mind, you're actually incorporating their body. So you're talk us through how you incorporate the device aspects with the gaming aspects. So this is not a joystick. This is not a mouse. This is much more involved.
Yes. So I think this is a chance to actually say that if you think about the pillars of medicine, there's been pharmacology, obviously, drugs. The second one you could think is devices and surgeries. Mm-hmm. And then the third is what you mentioned at the beginning, which is digital therapeutics. Well, what is digital therapeutics? It's software, not devices. Okay. It is a software as medicine, mm-hmm. right? Now, obviously, the regulatory environment is changing all the time. At the moment, they're still considering at the FDA software as a device, but mm-hmm. really, it's not. It's really a digital drug, a digital medicine. It's a piece of software targeting a particular condition in a particular area of your brain, even.
That's an interesting way to think about it. Not software as a medical device, but software as a therapeutic, truly as its name implies.
That's right. And I think that it's very important to understand that's what digital therapeutics is. It's a software solution, not a hardware solution.
Device and name only, yeah.
device in name only, yes. So in other words, then, of course, what happened, if I can just take a little bit of a tangent, which is, most people, when they now think of digital therapeutics in that way, they'll think about an app on a phone at home, mm-hmm. right? Sort of this notion, unfortunately, that's out there, that there's an app for everything and apps will save the world.
And a chatbot right? for every one of those, yeah.
Yeah, it's just not true, right? And what we realized is you needed something that was holistic, full body. In other words, it was both aesthetically and emotionally and socially engaging. It was your whole body, so it was cardiovascularly challenging. It was a sport. In other words, it was your body. But like sport, unlike exercise, it's cognitively challenging, mm-hmm. right? In other words, that's what a sport is, mm-hmm. right? It's strategic cognitive challenge plus cardiovascular challenge plus motor skill, right? And you need, it turns out, that you need all of it, right? You need this complex, multi-component in experience to really make the nervous system respond. And that's what we basically wanted to build. So we built, you know, we started by thinking, well, what would be an immersive, gorgeous environment? Well, we thought the ocean and all that blue. How do we distract the patient from looking at their own limbs? We didn't like avatars. How do we make them embody and disappear into an alternative reality where they actually feel that they are able to move and get better? So the idea was, with Omar and Pramit, the three of us, was can you create a form of animation that you can jack yourself into and almost become the cetacean, in this case, Bandit the dolphin, and swim in the ocean, make big arm movements in order to be skilled as the dolphin, and also be challenged by having to eat fish, avoid sharks, and explore the environment. So it was really a animation-based, experience-based version of the enriched environment plus training that had been doing well in monkeys and rodents for over half a century, if not more.
I think it's so interesting about this approach is that a lot of the things you're talking about are or would be considered essentially kind of the soft benefits, the subjective benefits, the things that you would get on a patient questionnaire. You know, how good did this make you feel versus the other? Whereas from the video game aspect, you really think of it more, before hearing what you just said, think of it more along the lines of, yes, you can quantify everything. You can quantify exact movements, response times, and get all of this objective data and be able to link that together. And what I'm hearing is much more that it's the combination of those two that totally takes it to some new space.
Yes. I mean, and the way I teach students to think about this, any student in a neuroscience department or any neurology resident, if you said to them, look, here's a pill, take it, and tomorrow morning you'll wake up an expert violinist or Wimbledon level tennis player.
I can do kung fu.
They would know it's ridiculous, yeah. Right? It is ridiculous to imagine that a pill would have that type of instant specificity and practice effect, right? But as soon as you have a neurological injury or disease, the obviousness of that not being feasible disappears from people's minds, right? They suddenly think, oh, I might not be able to be an overnight tennis player, but somehow I'll overnight repair my stroke or my spinal cord injury with a pill, okay? It's not how the nervous system works. The nervous system has to be behaving and experiencing and learning. The nervous system is not like a liver or a kidney, right? It is plastic. It learns. It behaves. So you need to find a new kind of medicine that actually exploits these properties that the nervous system has that other organs don't. Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. And so how does that change across different indications? So, the kind of fine motor skills and that kind of integrative environment that you're talking about with the kind of the I Am Dolphin product or the opportunity to kind of bridge those two things together. How does that change, say, when you move from a post-ischemic event to, say, a patient dealing with Parkinson's? Does that translate completely, or is it a totally different environment and game and everything?
Well, okay. So that's a really good question. So, what we are thinking about here is when I talk to you about the rodent experiments with enrichment and training, You know, that's been shown to be true across many different neurological conditions and diseases, whether it's spinal cord injury, whether it's stroke, whether it's neurodegenerative conditions. In other words, there's a universality to the benefits of enrichment and increased intensity and dosage of training. Now, we also know, for example, with spinal cord injury, that going earlier is better, all right? But we also know that in any neurological condition at any time, you can benefit from doing something fun and immersive and training-based. You know, there's work being done on Tai Chi, on dancing, on music, but none of these things can be easily protocolized or quantified. So we have trials ongoing right now with MindPod Dolphin in Parkinson's disease in Portugal. We have trials going on in Australia for multiple sclerosis. We have acute and chronic stroke trials. The Department of Defense has funded MindPod Dolphin to try and prevent onset of dementia in war veterans. So there's this belief that highly immersive environments are good for the nervous system no matter what disease or injury it has. Now, that's not to say that one doesn't want to tweak it, protocolize it, customize it for particular conditions. And one can do that by changing the characters, changing the exact movements that you're expected to make, the actual cognitive challenges you're given, the peripherals that you use, whether it's a hand training device or a weight support device. You know, so in other words, you can have your cake and eat it. You can have universal principles, and then you can actually parameterize that platform to give you the particularities of the requirements of a particular patient and disease. Okay, so you can have particularity and generality simultaneously. Does that make sense?
It does. So you can customize kind of the input outputs and the game mechanics, but let's go back to those kind of soft skills. How do you design a good game that is engaging, and are we going to end up where we're competing on kind of product and platform, and you know, I want my Mario recovery game versus my you know, some other character.
Exactly right. So there are a number of answers to that question, which we always get. Okay. So if I were to tell you that the pilot of the jet that you're in didn't use a flight simulator specifically designed to train them, but they just used an airplane game for the PlayStation 4 or the Xbox, I don't think you'd be too pleased.
Right.
Right. So in other words, there's this slightly ignorant and insulting idea that when it comes to devices and pharmaceuticals, you need pharmaceutical companies and device companies. But when you get to digital therapeutics, you can just take a game off the shelf, mm-hmm. right? It's kind of, to be honest, idiotic to think that way, right?
No, but that's not, I didn't mean to take another game off the shelf. What I mean is, are you going to get to a point where you are competing for FDA approval against other games that are really kind of trying to create, you know, more realistic games, you know, games that have celebrity sponsorships and things that, I mean, would you like something that is immersive in this way or is immersive in this way?
I think you're right. So just first of all, the type of animation that we have developed at Hopkins, which spun out, is really quite proprietary, and it is unique. It was unique enough for us to actually be visited by Pixar and get invited out to Pixar. In other words, the actual principles that we call neuroanimation, where you basically have a soft body physics engine, where you have emergent learnable dynamics that you have to jack into. In other words, this isn't what the video games that most people play are like, where what they do is they give you the illusion of expertise. You don't actually have to be very good at soccer to do well at FIFA or any of the basketball games. In other words, it all just boils down to button presses and a few switch movements mm-hmm. like the Wii. Mm-hmm. So what we realize is actually we're going to make this challenging for you at the movement level. So you're going to have to genuinely have to practice to get skilled. Okay, that's why most people, when they buy a game, you know, within a month, they're done, right? And they're mm-hmm. on to their next video game. Mm-hmm. That's not true of things like tennis, right? You play it for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. So you have to come up with a kind of game and a form of animation that has the longevity and the challenge of a sport rather than the short-lived sort of, you know, I've done this, I've mastered this game on the Xbox, what's the next one?
Yeah,
right? And it's a very deep question how you go from the short-lived nature of a game without the movement challenge to a gamified version of a sport. And that's very important difference. And yes, I think that once people begin to get the idea that you have to do that, there will be others that try and do it. I think you're absolutely right about that. But it's not that easy to do full body gaming and invent a new sport with a particular form of animation that isn't just flipbook drawing. And actually, there's a little bit of a barrier to entry there, I would say, Justin.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's interesting. That's a good kind of segue to talk about kind of your lab and the makeup thereof, because you've got what the layman might think of creating a video game that is a digital therapeutic that is just a bunch of developers and graphic designers sitting in a room. And then they have the kind of stereotypical vision of what does a kind of a neuroscience neurobiology lab look like, where it's, you know, a neuroscientist, a, you know, molecular biologist, cellular biologist, lab tech. And you're very much in a totally different area. You've got one of the most multifaceted teams I think I've ever seen. How did you kind of select for those different roles that you needed in the BLAM lab?
Yeah, you're just asking the best questions. In other words, it really gets to the heart of what's so exciting and what's so challenging about it, right? Because you're absolutely right. We sort of had, when I got to Hopkins and soon after, we formed almost like a binary star. There was Kata, mm-hmm. right, which was really a software and hardware design group. So when I met Omar Ahmad and Primeet Roy, as I said, they'd both graduated from computer science at Hopkins, and they, you know, they were really both engineers and artists, right? And it's not easy to know how to place such talented individuals within the traditional ecosystem of academic medicine, right? And then at the same time, BLAM was a, you know, brain learning animation movement lab, was a lab that was based on, you could say, human neuroscience, right? In other words, the model system isn't a bird, it isn't a worm, it isn't a mouse, it's the human. Okay, people tend to forget that humans are also a model system to do neuroscience in. And then the idea was, if you want to do good, clinically relevant, translational human neuroscience, then instead of high throughput gene sequencers and electron microscopes and, you know, all the things that go with animal models, you're going to need a different kind of team and a different kind of makeup to do human translational neuroscience. You're going to need artists, animators, software designers, hardware designers, engineers, right? And it's a different type of group in order to advance human translational neuroscience. And that's what we tried to do. But it's a challenge because you want to be able to bring such remarkably talented individuals in, because otherwise they'll go off to Google or Apple or Facebook, but not have to put them, if I may say, in the rat race of promotion and publications and grant writing and all the usual metrics of success that happen in academia. So you need to find a way to bring the best of industry and the best of academia together and try and create this environment where the engineers and the nerds are cheek by jowl with the clinicians and the more traditional neuroscientists, like you mentioned. And that's what we tried to do. And I think we succeeded. And one of the reasons was that, you know, the chairman of the Department of Neurology at Johns Hopkins, Justin MacArthur, and other people, including even the president of the university and other people at the university, were very interested in this idea once they began to clue into what we were trying to do. It took them a while to get it, but they were supportive. But it's always precarious. It's difficult to do this kind of work where you bring, you know, the gaming world and the arts world together with, you know, more rigorous traditional neuroscience. So I appreciate you noticing it, but it's not easy to do.
Well, and so I'd love to pull on that thread a little bit when you're talking about designing these kind of things, and when you were originally creating I Am Dolphin, and you're bringing that team together to do so. How did you match the kind of the game making and story development with the analytics and endpoints? And, you know, because you're looking, trying for subjective endpoints and questionnaires, you're trying for very objective, data-driven endpoints. How do you match all those? And how do you match all those personalities who you have such a diverse group of people? Everybody has their golden, sacred cows that they want to keep.
Yeah, yes, exactly. I think so. It's really good. I think of it a little bit like, what's it like to be a film director? Right? You have to bring the actors together. You need to bring the script writers together. You need to have the producers, the money men, all of that.
Very different from a target product profile kind of approach.
Yeah. You have to basically be willing to deal with a lot of very different personalities and skill bases. And I think one of the advantages was, and I think this is absolutely true, as I was very lucky, right? I actually got to meet two people, you know, Omar and Pramit, who really were peculiar, sort of odd geniuses, right? In so much that they were extremely technically competent. In other words, quite brilliant in terms of their programming skills, their analytical skills, but also extremely aesthetically sophisticated. In other words, they had real strong opinions about what counts as beauty, what a game should really be. So I think in a way I was lucky in so much that I happened to meet people who exemplified inside themselves those two aspects that you're talking about. And then, of course, once you have that core, then, you know, the therapists, the grad students, the postdocs, the scientists, the patients buy into it because they actually see how lovely it is. And what I always like to say is, if you're sick, why not at least enjoy it? Right?
Absolutely.
And so it was basically like a aesthetic upgrade plus science to what patients should experience. And in general, I think that the relationship between the Carter team and the patients and the therapists was remarkable. I mean, it was really a very natural marriage. It's quite incredible, really. It was almost as though the patients and the clinicians were waiting to be able to offer something this fun and beautiful to their patients.
And so you release I Am Dolphin, and then how did you get involved with Mind Maze?
Right. So I Am Dolphin was originally a game that, you know, Omar and Pramit were quite determined to make it have to actually meet the standards of regular gamers out there. So it actually went onto the App Store. It got a prize, you know, a lot of feedback was obtained. So it was actually quite a nice way of crowdsourcing healthy gamers to make a game that would actually be worthy of patients. So that in itself was an interesting experiment. I mean, they were quite ingenious in sort of honing its quality by asking, you know, regular gamers what needed to be done. So that was kind of interesting. But then, of course, what we realized is if you're going to develop something, and, you know, before we ever, you know, the Mind Maze story began, we had actually started a trial. So in other words, we were funded by the McDonald Foundation to do an acute stroke trial with Bandit the Dolphin. And, you know, that trial actually was accepted, and I think it actually comes online this week. So that was a very ambitious trial. It took place in New York, in Baltimore, and in Switzerland, where patients had to be within 5 weeks of their stroke, and then they got an hour in the morning of gameplay, an hour in the afternoon, five times a week for 3 weeks. So it was, I like to say, it's like having two squash lessons every day, 5 days a week for 3 weeks, right? A lot, you know, orders of magnitude more than you would ever get in a regular session.
Absolutely.
And what was exciting about it is that the result was positive. But anyway, we realized that if you wanted to sort of create a kind of robust clinical grade version of this, then it would have to spin out and be a company, right? You can't create a robust product beyond some prototyping stage in a lab. And that's when, you know, we created a startup, and then that startup was acquired by Mind Maze in 2018.
I'd love to dig into some of the, I guess, the other opportunities that you see, whether that's more focusing on developing into these other therapeutic areas, or in your own work, also looking at kind of motor learning and mastery, and some of the things you alluded to, learning, you know, kung fu and lots of squash practice in a very short period of time. You know, this gives you the opportunity to not just focus on recovery, but mastery.
So, yes. I mean, I think, you know, my maze was very much in the, you know, a company that was specifically interested in neurorehabilitation and digital therapeutics. And, you know, the way the company is currently placed in the digital therapeutic space is that it has a rehabilitation solution, in other words, rehabilitation itself of the kind that I spoke at the beginning, needed an upgrade. In other words, it needed to be gamified, quantified, you know, and made more consistent and protocolized. And so, in other words, MindMaze has what it's called its rehab DTX solution, the digital therapeutic solution to traditional rehab, sort of the MindMotion Go platform that it has. So that was something that they've been doing. Then they were interested in us because we were doing this other immersive, as I've described, repair-based behavior approach, which isn't necessarily to do with rehab or therapist. It's sort of a digital medicine in the neurospace. In other words, these two complementary behavioral approaches to nervous system disease and injury. Also, MindMaze was interested in developing assessment tools and analytics so that you could capture movement, capture cognition, and sort of actually quantify the response to the digital therapeutic solutions. So in other words, you have to create a kind of whole platform, right, of regulation and analytics and assessments along with these two different behavioral approaches. And that was what was interesting to us. So it's very much a clinical digital therapeutic in the neurospace company, with us really bringing this proprietary form of animation for neurological conditions where you try and repair, not just cope. So that was really like we had a joint mission, and, you know, we had this unique approach. They had the resources to scale it up, and that's what happened. So it's really clinical. With respect to what you're saying, which is, what about mastery? What about healthy people? What about skill? What about all of that? That's really outside the purview of the company. That's more gotcha. What BLAM is doing. That's what we do at BLAM. We're very interested in what is practice. Why do you get better with practice? You know, what's the difference between a skill and a habit? What's the difference between being skilled and being an expert?
Ooh, I'll take that one. What's the difference between being skilled and being an expert?
I think, you know, I don't know if you've heard of Anders Ericsson. You know, he was a psychologist that died, I think, just last year. He was the person that Malcolm Gladwell stole the 10,000-hour thing and sort of took it out of context, to be honest. But basically, Anders Ericsson came up with this idea of deliberate practice. Mm-hmm. And there, the point he made, which I agreed with, even though he couldn't really put much sort of neuroscientific flesh on it, was that there's a difference from being skilled at something versus a real expert. Okay, so in other words, you might become quite skilled at peeling an orange or making an espresso, right? You can practice and get really good at it. But that's not the same as being an expert at something like tennis or the violin. Mm-hmm. There, it's as much cognitive as it is motor. I don't know if you saw that amazing movie Free Solo about Alex Honnold.
Yes, I have a fear of heights, so it's very difficult to watch.
Yeah, I had the same feeling. I actually was interviewed on stage not long after seeing that, and I thought I should get an award for bravery just having watched it. But I think what's important about expertise is that he's not just a slightly better version of us going at the weekend to rock climb on a rock climbing wall. Okay. In other words, he's doing it in a qualitatively different way. Right. Another example is there are people that can remember a sequence of 300 to 400 digits that are read out to them.
Hyperthymesia. Okay? Yeah.
Yes. And that's not the same as the way you and I might remember 10 digits. So we might be able to practice and get 10 if we're lucky. They do hundreds and hundreds. They're not just scaling up what we do. They're doing something qualitatively different.
So you used a term in your paper, in one of your papers that I liked, neural caching.
There, the idea is that there's a kind of a ratchet that you, if you go to be coached, right, let's say a squash coach, and they say, okay, this is what you need to do to swing the racket, right? You need to stand sideways. You have to have your right foot in front of your left foot. You need to make sure that the racket face hits the ball flat. And you need to practice that, okay? And you eventually get good at swinging the racket. You're by no means at this point an expert at squash. You've just become skilled at a component of it, okay? Now you want to add something else, right? You have to say that now we're going to do a volley, or we're going to crouch low and scoop the ball from the back wall. You're only going to be able to practice this new component if you've automatized and cached the first one, because you can't concentrate overtly, simultaneously, on more than one component at a time. So if you want to build up expertise by beginning to add components, then you better be able to have automatized and gotten one of them out the way so that you can now concentrate on the next one. Do you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So in other words, to build up expertise by accumulating these component skills, you're going to have to do it in the right order, which is why we need coaches.
And why deliberate practice is so important.
Yes, because you basically need to store away one piece in your camel's hump so that you can get on to the next one. And that's probably one reason why it takes so long to become an expert at something, because there are so many components that you need to practice, cache, and then get on to the next one. And then on top of all that, you have to learn to combine them all, right? So that's one of the ideas behind expertise, is just the sheer accumulation of components, each of which needs to be practiced and automatized before you can do the next one. Does that make sense?
Right now, the products that are launched are in on screen, and as you are moving both your research and some of the products at the company, the movement from the screen to the visor, the virtual reality component, and truly becoming immersive. How does that change the game? How does that give you more opportunity to make them even more immersive and potentially have even more clinical benefit? And do you have any data around that yet?
I think, first of all, one has to be careful to prematurely assume that VR is the most immersive. Okay. That's first of all. In other words, there are some studies to suggest that people like big screens. Right. And the way we've been doing it is we create rooms, right? You walk in more and the lights go down and there's a big projection and you're just looking at the big wall with the projection.
Do you think it's the novelty versus familiarity, or is it?
I'm just saying that immersiveness is something that we have to get better at in terms of finding a way to quantify and create questionnaires to ask what that is. Right. Two, you know, if you're a patient over 65, people can get cyber sickness with VR goggles.
Vertigo, yeah.
They don't like it very much. Gotcha. It's not, they're not necessarily going to want to wear the goggles for hours a day. It's also slightly difficult to have in hospital settings with all the other things that a patient has associated with them. If you want to have an immersive environment in a room, you can definitely do it. But VR goggles at home, for example, you could trip over your coffee room table.
Sure. Then you're right back where you started, or worse. Yeah.
Sure, worse. So I think that we've certainly played around with VR versions of Bandit, and we're very agnostic with respect to the actual nature of the hardware that we use, whether it's AR, VR, screen. We will do whatever is most useful for that patient to get the cognitive and motor and cardiovascular workout they need. And VR is absolutely one way that you can do that, and it will get increasingly popular, I think. But one mustn't think, you have to basically go, what do I want my patient to experience first? What do I want them to see? And then you ask yourself whether VR is the best way in that particular case, rather than going, VR's cool, and now let's have everything have to accommodate that particular form of immersion. Does that make sense? I think you need to ask yourself empirically whether that's the right solution for this particular patient group and particular condition. And I'm not super convinced yet that it's the ultimate convergence point for immersive behavioral experiences.
Sounds like you haven't seen the separation of the data yet.
No, I mean, I think that's, there are many, many components to that. Is it practical? Can they keep it on? What environment do you put them in? Is it location-based? Is it home-based? There are a lot of variables about matching the actual content with the way it's delivered. And there's a lot of work to be done there yet, but it's quite a big, as you can imagine, parameter space.
And then, you know, kind of as you move into kind of the balance and designing these systems, or just thinking about these digital therapeutics, how do you think about the kind of the balance between perceived and real clinical benefit, cost pricing, and reimbursement? Because you're kind of in these early days where the benefit is still being proven, but I think is being shown through the data that to be there. The costs are going to be relatively high because you're talking about devices and software and services and data sharing and all that kind of stuff. But then reimbursement is probably still on the low side, or are you seeing that?
Well, I think it's very important to distinguish again between sort of rehabilitation, right? In other words, we know now that occupational and physical therapy work, right? And it would work better if they could give more of that and quantify it better and gamify it. And there you can utilize existing reimbursement structures, right? So a therapist just uses the Mind Motion Go digital therapeutic solution during one of their sessions, right? And, you know, there's a tele rehab version that is getting a lot of play, and therapists are now able to bill for a tele-rehab session.
But a lot of times the new therapeutics and, you know, as I talked about the kind of the cost and the software and the devices, is that feasible with the reimbursement being piggybacking on, you know, existing CPT codes and things like that?
I think for rehabilitation, there is a pathway there, right? And and that's ongoing. I think for what we've been talking about, which is this reparative, immersive neuro solution, what Bandit is. In other words, here it's completely separate and complementary to rehabilitation. And now you basically want a doctor to say, okay, when you go to the pharmacy and you pick up your neuro drug, we also want you to go and spend an hour and a half in this immersive room, right?
Yeah.
And because we now know that drugs for the nervous system do best when they're coupled with a very intensive behavioral experience. There's a lot of data coming out of that kind. That is first in class. You're absolutely right. That is going to have to require completely new codes, complete new reimbursement. And you know, I always say it's not that different from when dialysis came along, right? Mm-hmm. That patients needed to go three times a week for 4 to 6 hours of dialysis in a location. And there were fights over how that was going to be reimbursed, by the way, right? There's a history of how dialysis ended up being paid for, right?
And now it's barely paid for. It's almost more expensive to give it than it is to be reimbursed for it.
Right. So I agree with you that we're going to have to change the landscape. But, you know, just to understand the magnitude of this problem, most of the trials for neurodegenerative conditions have failed. Neuroprotection for stroke, the trials for Alzheimer's disease. Increasingly, there hasn't been a new psychiatric drug other than ketamine for 50 years, right? So everyone's beginning to realize that immersive physical activity-based solutions are essential for human health and longevity. If you look at COVID-19, who are the people who died from it? They were sedentary, they were over 65, they were diabetic, they were hypertensive, they were obese. Okay, over 50% of people over 65 worldwide do no physical activity of any kind. So in other words, what the world is beginning to realize is whether it's for healthy aging, neurodegenerative conditions, or chronic conditions in general, there's a need for a new medicine, right, to try and deal with these. Exercise works well for depression, for example.
So you're saying in the future, the neurological medicine cabinet will be in the cloud.
I think so. I think that what is going to, absolutely right. You're going to have a location-based immersive experience to deal with your chronic conditions, neurological or otherwise. And it's the only way that the pharmacology or the devices will actually show maximal benefit. But the elephant in the room is so huge because people don't realize you need to put someone in a room to have a behavioral experience, right? And I mean, think about, I don't know, your grandparents or your parents, right? And they live on the East Coast and it's winter, right? And we know that they need to do some physical activity, something cognitively challenging. What are they going to do? Mm-hmm. Where are they going to go? Right? There's nowhere for them to go. There's nothing for them to do. Mm-hmm. Unless you're wealthy and you can go skiing or you can be a member of a tennis club. Right. But what does your average 70-year-old hypertensive guy with, you know, early Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease, where do they go?
Yeah.
Do you see that? Do you see the magnitude of the problem?
Mm-hmm. Is there any preconceived notion or sacred cow in neuroscience that you would love to tackle?
So I have a number of them. I think one of them is this notion of the separation between the motor and the cognitive. In other words, this whole idea of the dumb jock and that being good at math or music is superior to being good at basketball, right? So that neuroscience has tended to almost make it seem that working with your hands and working with your brain are different. And I don't like that. It's not true. I think another area where I think people misunderstand is this notion that the brain is infinitely plastic and sort of very loose use of the term plasticity. The other one, of course, is what we've been discussing, that we need to have behavioral interventions for patients, not just drugs and devices. And then the other one is about intelligence. In other words, I co-host this online salon called the Learning Salon that started last summer and happens every Friday and has developed quite the following. It's a wonderful discussion forum to discuss artificial intelligence and neuroscience and human intelligence. And one of the things that I'm extremely interested in is to know what is it about human reasoning that has been so difficult to explain neuroscientifically and so difficult to reproduce in AI. And one of the things that I believe is we're not going to get there doing more of the same, you know, with AlphaGo and other video games and things like that, that deep neural nets are not going to be the only answer. So those are the areas which I'm very interested in.
Very cool. How can listeners get in touch with you or contact your lab or about your research or get in contact with MindMaze?
I think MindMaze is quite easy to get in touch with. I think you go to their website and there are a number of ways to contact there. When it comes to us, the Blam Lab and Carter have websites. You just Google Blam Lab, Google Carter, and there are ways there to get in touch with us. We're quite receptive. So I know those are three different things, the Blam contact, the Carter contact, and the MindMaze contact. And then the company, the subsidiary company that's sort of platforming Bandit is M Square Health, which is a subsidiary of MindMaze. And M Square Health, that's capital M Square Health, also has a website.
Excellent.
I know it's a lot. I hope I haven't bombarded you with too much stuff.
No, that's great. Plenty of touch points for folks to get in touch with you and learn more about your research. Well, Dr. Krakauer, thank you so much for taking the time to
and thank you for asking such really fantastic questions.
I appreciate it. I'm very interested in this area and your work, and very much appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you very much. Take care.
You too.
Bye.
Thank you to Dr. John Krakauer, neurologist, director of the Blam Lab, and professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins University, and chief medical and scientific advisor to MindMaze, for sharing his time and his research with us today.
If you like this episode of the Tomorrow Scale podcast, please subscribe, write a review, follow us on Twitter, or support us on Anchor or Patreon. These are stories from the cutting edge of science and medicine. This is the Tomorrow Scale podcast. I'm Justin Briggs.